KZSU, Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as, in the fall, an assistant professor at Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Today, I'm very excited to have on one of the leading intellectual property public interest litigators in the United States, and that's a high statement, but it's accurate in the case of Fred von Lohmann from Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF for short. Fred is among many things that he's done has in the last several years handled a number of very high profile cases in the intellectual property litigation realm. Particularly Grokster is the one that's most familiar to people, but several others that we're going to be discussing today. EFF is an organization well known, becoming increasingly well known throughout the world, but certainly well known in the Bay Area and for those people that focus on technology for its diverse litigation and policy efforts, not only in the intellectual property sphere with respect to technology, but in privacy and in a variety of other areas. And I would ultimately endeavor to hopefully have on as many people from EFF as I can, because I try to go up front in the beginning of my show and lay out my biases, and so I'm heavily biased in favor of what EFF does. I don't make any bones about that. I don't think it's really much of a shock to anyone that listens to Hearsay Culture, but in Fred's work in particular, I can say that there's very little that I've disagreed with in terms of the positions that EFF takes. We are going to discuss several of those cases, but also discuss public interest litigation generally and how technology litigation in particular in the public interest sphere has mutated, changed, and how it's done today. But in Fred, we're very lucky to have on someone who has extensive experience in this sphere and someone who also is a graduate of Stanford Law School. EFF itself, you can find at EFF.org, and for those that are interested in learning more about EFF, you know, not during the show, I'd say listen to the show, but then afterwards, check out the website, because the website itself is not only interesting from the perspective of where technology is today and where the hot issues are, but it's also actually a wonderful research source. I've used the website in my own articles to track down primary source material like complaints and answers and other filings in court. So I don't want to do much more of an introduction here, because I want to get the conversation started with Fred, who has graciously come down from San Francisco to KZSU studios on the Stanford campus. Fred, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
It's my pleasure.
Let's start right off. I think, like I said in the introduction, people are very familiar with EFF, but they may not be as familiar with you and how you got to where you are. So by way of background, what brought you to entering the intellectual property public interest litigation sphere?
Well, it's interesting. I actually had a very clear conversion moment, or conversion experience, I guess you could call it. I remember being in law school. This was back in the early 90s here at Stanford. And I was an avid reader of Wired magazine, which at the time was really a cutting-edge publication. It was their first year. I remember I started reading it from the second issue. And I was interested in this internet thing and all of the new things that were beginning to emerge. I mean, this was before the World Wide Web, after all. Mm-hmm. And I remember picking up an issue, and in it was an article by John Perry Barlow, who some of your listeners may know as one of the songwriters for the Grateful Dead. Others of your listeners may know as one of the founders of EFF. Mm-hmm. And John Perry had an article in Wired, which is still quite famous, that was about the coming collision between intellectual property and the internet, and the possibilities the internet was going to create. And I read the piece, and immediately on putting the magazine down, I knew that's something I would love to spend my career working on. And I say that, you know, first and foremost, I'm a fan. I mean, my chief motivation in doing the work I do is I am a great admirer and fan of music, film, television, and the creators that work in those industries. I really, you know, I don't know who I would be if I didn't have my favorite music, the novels that have meant so much to me, the film, the television shows. And it really has always bothered me, and I think has bothers all fans, to see the way the industry often treats both the artists and the fans, mm-hmm. Behaving as though being a fan, sharing your enthusiasm, is something that, you know, is illegal or something that is, you know, tolerated only at the margin.
Right.
And, you know, fans have always had this experience. It's not unique to the digital era. I think fans are more persecuted today than ever before, but certainly you can go back to the 50s, 60s, 70s and witness the campaign against people who were sharing concert bootleg recordings, the kinds of attacks that the home taping debate in the 70s, for your listeners who go back that far, you know, this notion that everyone with a cassette deck was a thief and an enemy of the recording industry, followed then by the attacks on VCRs and home taping of video and television. You know, so I come from a place where I say, listen, if it weren't for the fans, there would be no music industry. There would be no movie industry. And so, you know, for me, my motivation to go into this area, intellectual property in the public interest, has always sprung from that motivation.
It's, you know, that's really well put. And in fact, I was thinking, boy, that's a better explanation for why I'm doing this as well than I've come up with, because like you, I'm a huge music fan and also an amateur musician. I grew up in a house where my father is an amateur pianist, although I think he probably just should have done it full time. My mother's an artist, and I think I've struggled with how to define it. I think you defined it well. Now, you probably share this experience, or maybe you don't, so I want to run it by you. As a fan, there's often then the follow-up comment, given the positions that I've both of us take, and we'll talk in more detail about intellectual property, but given the general view that you're advocating something less than a strict, controlled intellectual property environment, the argument being, well, what about the small artist? And ultimately, the point is, you don't care about the little guy by taking these positions. Now, it's a simplification. I think it's even a perversion of the position itself, but I've heard that quite often, especially from artists and musicians who think that when I say what I say about things like fair use, that I'm advocating piracy. How do you respond, or to the extent you've heard that criticism, how do you respond to it as a fan?
Well, as a fan, I think, and I would say more generally, my response to that argument is, listen, the internet is not the enemy of the small artist. Mm-hmm. Never has been, never will be. Mm-hmm. The internet is the single most exciting, empowering new tool, new mechanism to help the small artist, and particularly the small artist, to make a living, find an audience, you know, do what they love doing, than anything that has come certainly in the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
Today, you just look, I mean, people make that argument, and nowadays all I have to do is, you know, point to things like YouTube and MySpace.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, 5 years ago, you'd hear this argument, people would say, well, what about the small artist? And, you know, I would sort of say, well, let's put it this way, as Courtney Love once put it, most famously, the harm that's done to me by my fans is nothing compared to the harm that's done to me by my label. She, of course, used slightly more colorful language,
right,
but
right,
in deference
right.
to being on radio, I'll edit a little. But that
is
the substance of what she had to say.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, today we not only have the example that, you know, record labels, the big industries have never taken terribly good care of the small artist. In fact, you see over time, you know, more and more emphasis on major, huge blockbuster hits. And rather than, I mean, that makes more money, that's more profitable for a big industry than cultivating artists. So it used to be I could just say, well, it's not as though the current system is doing small artists much good. Now you can also point and say, and in fact, new technologies, new avenues made possible by the internet are doing an incredible amount of good. And so you look at places like YouTube, not a week goes by that somebody doesn't take, put something up on YouTube and then become a major new star or a new, you know, I just heard that the guy who founded Ask a Ninja, which some of your listeners may have seen. It's a video, sort of short-based, serialized piece that where a guy dressed as a ninja sort of takes a humorous take on kind of issues of the day.
Yeah.
He apparently has recently signed a major deal in Hollywood. This is something, it's hard to imagine someone 10 years ago being able to, from pure grassroots without any backing from a studio or a television network or, you know, a rich guy or anything
Right.
finding an audience and turning that into a real exciting career opportunity. And one of my clients, Jib Jab, most famous for their This Land Is Your Land parody during the Kerry-Bush election cycle in 2004.
Right.
Another great example. Two guys in a garage down in L.A. You know, they were never going to get a studio executive to call them back, right?
Right.
They didn't have an agent. They weren't in that world, right? I mean, they weren't Entourage,
yeah.
right? They were not living the Entourage life.
Uh-huh.
But they put this thing together really in their garage on a lark, and it was seen by millions of people and then got them a spot on The Tonight Show. Jay Leno thought it was great and hysterical and wanted them on. And then since then, they've done a series of these short animated pieces. They've gotten commissions to do pieces for Sundance Film Festival. You know, they've basically sort of by pulling themselves up by their bootstraps and finding their own audience – created a way to really make an exciting living out of doing what they love. And so, I mean, the stories, I could go on and on.
Right.
Today, there is no shortage of stories about how the little guy has made it thanks to the copying that the internet has made possible, the distribution possibilities, and the ability to reach an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when people say that my view of intellectual property harms small artists, you know, that just can't be right, because my view of intellectual property says that things like YouTube and MySpace are good, and we should be grateful they exist, and we should support them in the law, and we see what the major industry view is.
Yeah.
Their view is, we are going to sue these companies. These companies shouldn't exist. They should never have been allowed to build the businesses they have without asking our permission first.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I frankly, you know, the question from my mind is, if you're a small artist, would you rather a world where the only people whose permission you need is the fans, or would you like a world where every new thing has to get permission from a major media company first? I think the answer to that is clear.
And, you know, and we're going down this path a little in more detail now than, you know, than normal. I'd want to come back to EFF generally in a moment to contextualize it for the listeners. But I think what you're referring to also ultimately is a recognition about the changing business model, that exists in the entertainment industry generally. And part of the assumptions I think that go into some of these arguments, especially when we talk about things like royalty streams, and when you talk to, industry lawyers, and I was one, although at the litigation level, several years ago, although the cases I did were really pretty straightforward copyright violations, and we're talking about things like straight piracy. It didn't get into the fair use stuff. But when you talk about the financing of the industry, and you talk about current royalty streams funding current research and development, and et cetera, and so forth, we're talking about a business model which the internet entirely undermines. So I guess before we get to EFF generally, I guess I want to ask you this follow-up question, which is people, many people again, who take the view as a by the industry, say this is going to destroy media as we know it, and that the big media, whether it's print journalism or the big labels or whatever else, are going to die, and we don't want that response.
Yeah, I think that's ridiculous. I think the first part is right. The internet is going to completely alter and transform media as we know it. The second part, that's somehow bad and the law ought to step in to stop that, is just absurd.
Mm-hmm.
You'll only need a little bit of history to understand that this is not new, right? The entertainment industries have been radically transformed by new technologies for a century. You just need to go back and read some of the incredible controversy that surrounded the introduction of the player piano at the beginning of the 20th century to see just how much this is of the eternal recurrence of the same, right?
Right.
You have a situation where the music industry in 1900, as, you know, almost with one voice, said the player piano is terrible technology. It's going to destroy the American music industry and undermine music as we know it today.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, made sense because back then the music industry sold sheet music.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were in the sheet music business, you were right. The player piano was the death of your industry.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the beginning of a music industry that is 1,000 times larger, reaches more people, makes more money, employs more artists than the music industry that came before.
Mm-hmm.
So my answer is copyright law should be there for the fans and the creators over the long haul, not a regulatory mechanism that protects today's industries at the expense of tomorrow's. Mm-hmm. Imagine, for example, if the sheet music guys could have had the equivalent of digital rights management in 1900,
yeah,
such
right.
that they could say, this song will not play on a player piano unless you get our permission first.
Mm-hmm.
And that had basically killed off the player piano, and then, of course, the player piano ultimately led to the phonograph, which ultimately led to all the music we listen to today.
Yeah.
Imagine if, in order to protect the music industry of 1900, Congress had enacted laws to block that very disruptive but very valuable and important innovation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's exactly the same lesson today. Yes. We may well have a world where today's major record labels are completely wiped out, but they will be replaced, I'm quite confident, by a bigger, more responsive, more vibrant music industry than they are today. I mean, that has been the lesson of every new technology, every disruptive new technology of the last 100 years. There's no reason to think the internet is somehow the single exception to that rule.
The we're going to come back to this. I do want to, for the benefit of the I think relatively few admitted listeners that aren't familiar with EFF of this show, but very brief overview of EFF. You mentioned it's co-founding by John Perry Barlow. What is the organization and where is it headquartered? This the top level.
Sure. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, better known as EFF, is a nonprofit public interest organization. We're a 501c3, depending on user donations, and by all means, we're tax deductible. If you care about the things you hear, you should think about donating and joining EFF.
Mm-hmm.
We are based in San Francisco. We've been around for 16 years. We actually celebrated our so-called Sweet 16 at a party this year in San Francisco. So we've been around a long time. People often say, well, wait, that's before the internet. And actually, it's not quite before the internet. The beginnings of what we today know as the internet were already there. And in fact, EFF was founded at one of the early collisions between law and these new technologies, a case involving Steve Jackson Games, which was a Texas-based games company that made paper games, like board games.
Mm-hmm.
As a kid, actually had a few of their games. And it turns out that in the late 1980s, the federal government, the FBI, in an effort to find some supposedly leaked AT&T phone documents, basically swept down on Steve Jackson Games and seized all their computers because they were running a bulletin board, a so-called BBS for people who remember back in those days. And someone had said that the documents in question had been uploaded to this BBS. And the FBI at the time, acting on a total lack of understanding about what computers are and what search warrants mean in that context, took all their computers, basically shut down the company. And a number of people found out about this because the bulletin board culture, the BBS culture, people, you know, knew about what was going on other BBSs. And there was a conversation that began on The Well, which is one of the first virtual communities based in in the San Francisco area anyway. And a number of people on The Well said, this is ridiculous. This is clearly an example of how lawyers and police and the feds don't understand new technology. And as a result, are trampling on the constitutional rights of people who use that technology. And somebody needs to stand up for those constitutional rights for the people who use new technologies and say, hey, wait a minute. A search warrant means you get to take the things that are relevant to your investigation, not everything with a plug.
Yeah.
And that was the first legal fight. EFF was really founded in response to that issue. And 16 years later, we continue to do basically exactly the same mission. Sort of succinctly put, we think you take the same constitutional rights into the virtual world as you enjoy in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And we are there to fight for the people who are using new technologies and having, you know, and in doing so, find that somebody out there thinks they don't enjoy the same legal rights, whether it's the federal government, local police, copyright owners, phone companies. You know, there's no shortage of work, as you might imagine.
Right.
The last 16 years have shown that these new technologies are transforming lots of parts of our economy and our culture, And at the same time, somebody needs to stand up when they're attacked in the legal system and on the policy front and say, hey, wait a minute. You have free speech rights. You have rights to free expression. You have privacy rights. You have Fourth Amendment rights. You didn't leave those rights at the threshold of your modem.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and as I mentioned in the introduction briefly, of course, we're focusing, today on the intellectual property sphere, but EFF, you know, does great work in a variety of areas, including privacy and, my own research and electronic voting and the operations there, and the list goes on. I want to ask you this question because you hear it about public interest litigation generally, but you also hear it about EFF. And it's a criticism, but I think it's one worth asking about. Public interest litigation being what it is, like any litigation, you don't choose the facts. The facts come to you and you deal with them. And oftentimes public interest litigators, and EFF is no exception, are criticized for saying, oh my God, you brought this case or you defended this case in a certain way, and bad law has been created. And it would have been so much better if you just hadn't done anything. And especially in the technology field, I don't have to tell you, the law is being created right now, and very often, simply by virtue of how the laws are written and the interests that are there, the decisions are not going, not in all cases, and I think it's getting better, but a lot of cases haven't gone the way that you and I would like. How do you respond, and I'm not asking you to speak on behalf of EFF, but, you know, personally, how do you respond to the idea that it would just be better to not take the hard case or not take the case where there's a risk of having a bad decision, in favor of just letting things work themselves out however else they would, and of course, which begs the question, how are they going to be fixed? So I don't want to answer the question for you, but how do you respond to that criticism?
Well, as another public interest litigator once said to me, she said, you know, if you're winning all your cases, you're taking the wrong cases, right? And obviously, we are trying to take the cutting edge cases that are raising important issues that have not previously been addressed, what in the legal sphere people call impact litigation. Mm-hmm. And you run the risk that you're going to lose some, no question. And I completely agree. You got to get in there on those cutting edge cases because, you know, if you're not there, then the law gets made the other way. And so 5-10 years down the road, it's a fait accompli because no one stood up to fight, you know, to take on the fight. Mm-hmm. That being said, frankly, we at EFF win the majority of the cases we get involved in. So there's this impression that, you know, we're always losing because the entertainment industry has infinite money and infinite lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. It's not the truth. The reality is that the entertainment industry, I often say, you know, their infinite money and their infinite lawyers are some of my best allies in the sense that they chronically overreach. Mm-hmm. They are pushing for positions that federal judges, bless their heart, often recognize as being one-sided and unreasonable. And all you need to do is get up in court and present the other side. And often you will find that reasonable, you know, most federal judges are not copyright experts. They are, you know, I think there was a study done that said that most federal judges see less than a handful of copyright cases in their entire careers on the bench. Mm-hmm. But so you really need to be there to explain that there is another side. And that also includes the legislative and policy realm as well. You know, Congress, they are lobbied by the entertainment industry every year, year in, year out about mm-hmm. these issues. And I find when I go up there that many staffers are incredibly eager to hear the other side. Mm-hmm. There is a level of fatigue on the part of staffers from having heard the same thing over and over again from the recording industry and the motion picture industry. And, you know, these staffers are young guys, men and women, right? These are staffers who are generally in their 20s or 30s. These are people who know the internet quite well, even if their bosses like Senator Stevens may think the internet is a series of tubes. The staffers know better. And so when they hear the sort of lobbying rhetoric of the entertainment industry, they know it's wrong. They feel in their bones that they're not getting the real story, mm-hmm. but there's nobody else who shows up, mm-hmm. Except for people like EFF, Public Knowledge, the other public interest groups that are engaged. And so, I think, it's remarkable, you know, the old adage that, you know, 3/4 of winning is showing up. I think there's a lot of truth to that. My problem is not that I feel that the cards are stacked against me and I can't win. My problem is I feel like there's so many battles where I could make a difference, that I wish I wish we had more resources. Mm-hmm. EFF has 10 lawyers, 3 of us focus full time on intellectual property, and boy, I mean, there's no shortage of cases that need that engagement. We'll talk a little bit about this, but you just look at YouTube, and the number of fair use, free speech kinds of activities there that are being taken down by entertainment companies, by people who don't want to be criticized. I mean, you know, every one of those things is an opportunity to make good law. Mm-hmm. And, we're definitely looking for those. But there's always going to be more than we can take. And, I have no regrets. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about MGM versus Grokster, which, you know, I'm not proud to have been on the losing side of the Supreme Court's 9-0 decision. But I will say this. I'm glad we took that case. I have no regrets about the positions we took. I think they were the right positions. I think that view is vindicated by the fact that we won every single judge on the way up until we got to the Supreme Court. So it's not as though I was losing. I was winning until, you know, ultimately the Supreme Court punted on the hard questions and sort of took the easy way out. That's a great example of a case. Sometimes there are cases that you have to take because the law is going to be made whether you're there or not. Mm-hmm. And that was a case where, what was that time? Morpheus, the sort of leading peer-to-peer file sharing application. They were being sued by the entertainment industry. That case was going to make law. Mm-hmm. There's no two ways about it. The defendant had enough money to hire lawyers to fight. They had every incentive to fight. The entertainment industry wanted to destroy not only that company, but to create a precedent they could use to destroy other peer-to-peer companies. Mm-hmm. So that law was going to get made, whether we were there or not.
Right.
And so I have no regrets about saying the law that did get made, I confidently can say, is better because we were there.
And I'm proud to, remain affiliated with CIS, as you know, started up the Fair Use Project and ultimately, has faced, I mean, before Fair Use, but certainly faces the same, set of dilemmas. And I think, it's a topic that we could continue doing, but I do want to take a short music break and then come back and talk about, the specifics of some of the cases that you've handled. You're listening to, KZSU's Hearsay Culture, Dave Levine in conversation with Fred Von Lohman from EFF. Before we continue the conversation with Fred Von Lohman from EFF here on Hearsay Culture, now's the time of the show where I ask you for money for KZSU. Although I should say that I think, frankly, an equally worthy donation would be to EFF. So there's a certain, in the public interest world is also a competition for dollars. So now I'm going to do the pitch for KZSU. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station here at Stanford that relies on listeners' donations to continue its diverse program. If you're interested in learning more about making a donation, or even better, if you've already learned enough and you've decided I'm going to make a donation, you can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on underwriting, or donate to KZSU. There's two links there. Or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless of what you do, please keep listening to KZSU. So we're back with Fred, and Fred, I think it's a good time now to kind of delve into some of the cases, at least in the 20 or so minutes that we have left, to discuss the entire world of intellectual property litigation. Shouldn't be too difficult in 20 minutes. But you started with Grokster, and perhaps, we can continue the conversation there by saying, what do you think at this point, the decision's still relatively new, but what do you see as the impact of Grokster so far?
Well, let me back up a little and give your listeners a little bit of context
and
hit a couple of broader themes.
Okay.
I mean, I think if I had to sum up the bulk of what I've done at EFF and what EFF's agenda on intellectual property has been in the last 6 years, I would have to focus on two things. One, we are intent on protecting innovation and the freedom to innovate from copyright law, particularly copyright law as wielded by today's large entertainment industries. So there is the pro-innovation theme that runs through a number of our cases. And the second theme is free speech and free expression, and trying to protect that from encroachment by copyright law, copyright lawyers, and frequently entertainment industries, although not always. Sometimes you have smaller players who are intent on abusing copyright law to silence a critic, silence new creativity. So fair use, free expression, that's sort of the second theme. So those are the two big themes that I think unify most of what EFF is working on in this area. So Grokster, MGM versus Grokster, is sort of the key element in the protecting innovation end of our work, certainly in the last 5-6 years. That was a case that was brought by the entire entertainment industry. I often, in my bio, mention that I have been involved in litigation against every major music label, every major movie studio, every major television network, and most of the major cable stations you've ever heard of. And most of that I can say simply by that one case. It was literally every entertainment company you've ever heard of sued two, well, originally three peer-to-peer file sharing application developers. The pieces of software that were at issue were Morpheus, Kazaa, and Grokster. And so what happened is they sued the companies that made the software. And the key question is, if you make a piece of technology that can be used for infringement, but can also be used for non-infringing things, when will you be held responsible for what your customers are up to? That is an absolutely critical question for innovators, because after all, if you make a photocopier, CD burner, hard drives, personal computers, modems, routers, every one of these technologies makes copies all day long, and many of those copies will be infringing, inevitably. Right. I mean, if you took a poll of what Cisco routers, you know, planted in America's ISPs actually do all day, most of what they do all day is forward infringing packets between users who are probably violating copyright law. No one would suggest that Cisco should be held liable. After all, if Cisco were, then the business of making routers would be a very different business. It would be a business that you couldn't make a move. You couldn't move an inch unless you first got the sign-off of all the major entertainment companies, for fear that you would be sued, and if you're held responsible in the shoes of every user out there, well, you're out of business. And so getting that balance right is the only reason we have technologies like the iPod, the personal computer, the VCR, the photocopier, all of those technologies. We only have them today because the creators, the inventors, the innovators who built them felt that they could do it without getting sued into a smoking hole. And so that was the issue. The peer-to-peer software developers, whatever else you may think about their product or the uses to which people put their product, those products themselves do not have, you know, an infringing use separate from the non-infringing uses. They are like photocopiers. They are agnostic as to the use. And so the key was we wanted to make sure that we protected this zone of innovation. And the entertainment industries, of course, were intent on taking that ground for themselves, essentially reversing the precedents that protected companies like Sony for building the Betamax and Apple for building the iPod. They wanted to change the underlying copyright laws to be able to reach more innovators when they made technologies that were used for infringement. So that was the big case, started in 2001, got to the Supreme Court in 2005, relatively quick, actually, by legal standards. The Betamax VCR case, which was kind of the big previous case on this topic that went to the Supreme Court in 1984, took 8 years to wend its way through. So we managed to do it in four. And in the case, ultimately, as I said, we won all the way up the chain at both the first the district court level and then the Court of Appeals here in the Ninth Circuit. They all endorsed our point of view that if you have a piece of technology that is able to be used for both infringing and non-infringing things, then the vendor, the creator and distributor, could not be held responsible when some people, even when many people, use the technology in ways that infringed copyright. The Supreme Court, once they got it, they basically, and this is the reason that, frankly, you have a 9-0 majority opinion, they were unanimous, The only time you ever get unanimity out of this Supreme Court is when they have found an easy way out that ducks the issue, right? I think that's true not just in copyright,
yeah, right,
but in every area.
Right.
Whenever you see a 9-0 opinion, you say to yourself, oh, somebody found a way to duck the hard question.
Uh-huh.
And they did in this case. They said, if a technology distributor actively encourages people to use their technology to infringe copyright, induces as the language they used, then they will be held responsible. So you build a technology that's capable of lots of uses, but you advertise it and encourage people to use it to infringe, well, you'll be responsible. To which my answer was, you know, okay, fine, right? I mean, that really wasn't the question that we were asking the court. It's not the question that the lower court rulings addressed, but it provided the Supreme Court an easy way to sort of mischaracterize the peer-to-peer file sharing developers as really, you know, encouraging infringement. In our view, that wasn't accurate. To the extent it was true, any of the issues the Supreme Court pointed to the extent that stuff was true, it was activity that happened many years earlier, and I think if you go to a website of a company like LimeWire, for example, which today is probably the leading peer-to-peer file sharing application, you'll see there's nothing on LimeWire's website that encourages people to infringe. In fact, quite the contrary. So the underlying question is still alive. What if I make a piece of technology and I don't encourage people to use it for bad things, but nevertheless, many people do? Am I going to be responsible every time somebody uses my machine, my device, my software to infringe copyright? And sadly, we still don't have an answer. Now, I think we did a lot of good in Grokster by minimizing the damage that would have been done. The Supreme Court took the easy way out. That's frustrating for me because we still don't have an answer. But it's better than if they had taken the entertainment industry's road and given us an answer that it would have put the entire technology sector potentially at risk.
The for those that haven't read the opinion, I want to make sure that there's understanding of this point, because you point out the standard of encouraging infringement. One could deduce from that that therefore if you don't infringe or don't encourage infringement, then your technology is clear. But that's not the deduction that you can draw from the Grokster opinion.
That's right. The Supreme Court left us in the same state of uncertainty that motivated the lawsuit in the first instance. Right? I mean, if it were clear that you weren't in trouble if so long as you didn't encourage people to infringe, well, then there would have been no lawsuits against peer-to-peer file sharing in the first place, certainly not against all of the companies that have been sued, beginning with Napster, going through Aimster. The three famous cases that resulted in opinions are Napster, Aimster, and Grokster, sort of the Stir trilogy, if you will. But there were many other cases brought, Audio Galaxy, Scour, eDonkey. Actually, I think eDonkey wasn't sued. LimeWire has now been sued. You know, there were lots of lawsuits filed. And, in fact, the same principle is today being used to sue XM, the satellite radio guys, for distributing a device that allows you to time shift your satellite radio. It's, you know, the same theory has been used to target technologies that have nothing to do with peer-to-peer. And that was always our concern, that once a precedent gets set, it applies to everybody, not just, you know, the Betamax case is still cited today, even though the Betamax VCR is ancient history.
Right.
So, yeah, the problem today is the same as the problem in 2001, which is technology innovators today have no legal certainty. I cannot advise a technology company who comes to me and asks, what can I do to be sure that I won't be sued for infringement based on infringing activity by my users? I cannot give, and I don't think any lawyer can give, an answer that says, okay, as long as you do X, Y, and Z, you're safe. It's not true. As somebody once put it recently in an email to me, so what you're saying is every innovator is basically taking a spot in the casino, and if you get lucky, you hit the jackpot, and if you don't get lucky, the lawsuit takes you down. And unfortunately, that is, I think, a relatively accurate characterization of the legal environment that innovators face. So companies like Sling, that makes the Slingbox, very popular new space shifting technology. People like XM, who bring you the new XM time shifting for satellite radio. All of those companies, as well as all of the new internet companies, they're all facing the same legal uncertainty. And that already has a chilling effect on the amount of innovation we get.
We saw, we only have about 10 minutes left, sadly. We saw in the immediate aftermath of the Grokster decision, I mean, literally within days, there were announcements of peer-to-peers that shut down. And, you know, which of course, you know, is exactly what we don't want to have happen as a result of a lawsuit and a decision that says, well, don't induce infringement and you'll be okay. And of course, that isn't what the companies decided and isn't indeed what the court said. But there was a lot of confusion around what the decision meant. And I guess we don't have as much time as I'd like to get into it, but you mentioned the innovation aspect of it. And I know that you're going to be teaching a course at Stanford Law School in the fall in innovation. Perhaps you could mention that course and then kind of tie it into this problem. Because for those, you know, taking it down to the practical level, for those people that are looking at the law from a practical perspective, I mean, theoretically, it is a fascinating area in terms of looking ultimately. I had Todd Davies on from Stanford talking about behavioral economics, which of course ties directly into IP, and it's kind of bizarre that there haven't been more connections made in that realm. But it has such a wide berth from a theoretical standpoint and from a jurisprudential standpoint. But for those that are looking at this practically, you're teaching a course in innovation. What's the title of the course? What is the focus? But then on a practical level, what is ultimately the general advice that you give? What should a company do?
Yeah, that's actually exactly what the course is going to be about. It's mm-hmm. called Intellectual Property in the Innovation Industries. Mm-hmm. And the goal is to bring a very pragmatic perspective to this issue. So in my experience, it's vividly clear that many of the innovative technologies that we see are shaped directly by legal advice. Mm-hmm. It's not as though the engineers just get to go out there and invent what the people want. It's not as though a company can just ask, what do the fans want? Let's build something.
Yep.
No. You start there, and then you have many, many meetings with your lawyers. And your lawyers say, this is risky, change this, do this, alter that, don't do that, focus here instead. And then what we get out of the other end of sort of the innovation process is a product that has been stamped by the law. Mm-hmm. Users often can't see it, because if you're not a lawyer, you don't recognize that the shape of that innovation, the reason that corner has been cut, the reason that feature isn't there, is because of the law. The lawyers can recognize it. And so that's really my goal, is to teach a class that basically allows you to decode innovative new things we use every day and figure out to what extent the law ended up defining these innovations. And from my perspective, there's a real risk here. We don't want the law defining innovation. We want the market to define innovation.
Right.
Of course, the law has a role to play. You have to limit certain things. It makes sense. But I think the law has gone too far. And in any event, the goal of the course here is to just help people recognize it. And then we can have a debate about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. But you have to start by seeing it. So the goal is to bring in people like, you know, the product counsel who work on YouTube, for
mm-hmm.
example.
Mm-hmm.
Every feature of YouTube bears the imprint of legal advice. Every feature of keyword advertising on Google and Yahoo bears the imprint of legal advice. New kinds of technology like Lala.com just launched a new music download site. That's also, I mean, you know, things people use every day, MySpace, you know, Flickr, mm-hmm. All of these new technologies that we've come to kind of take for granted and weave into our lives are designed with legal advice in mind, not just engineering advice. And so that's the goal of the course, is to do exactly what you say, let people see how the law affects real choices that affect real businesses.
Do you, when you look at the, and again, we have about 4 minutes left, so I'm going to ask a truncated version of this question, which is where do you see open source and the success of open source fitting into this model?
Well, open source, I think, is a critical part of the information ecology around the world and in our country as well. And Larry Lessig has pointed this out, and others as well, and I think they're exactly right. Open source is the check that holds some of the worst tendencies of monopoly and intellectual property at bay, right? So, and the government as well. So the key here is if programmers can build technologies for themselves that are not subject to these kinds of pressures, you know, you don't, where people aren't worried about, well, what will Viacom think if we build this feature? In the open source world, the open source world is much more directly responsive to what technology makes possible and what fans want. And so it at least shows us what is possible. And then we can decide whether or not, oh, okay, well, maybe we don't want to let that be in the market or not. But the risk is we live, if we live in a world where there is no open source, we may never know what's possible. We may never know what the lawyers have taken away from us.
There's, in the last 2 minutes here, I do want to give an opportunity to mention again the EFF website where people can learn more about EFF and also consider donating. But I guess my last question for you, kind of the sum up question, is, you know, if you were to predict 2 years from now what kinds of issues are going to be litigated, now, of course, God only knows what technologies exist 2 years from now, but based upon your sense of the market, what would you say if you had to, returning to the betting analogy, make a bet on what would be litigated, what would be the case or the scenario that you'd see being the pitched battle?
I think it's actually 2 years in the coming 2 years, it's really the same battlefronts that we've seen in the last five. The two hot areas are going to be innovation versus copyright. We're already seeing that in lawsuits involving Cablevision, XM radio. New technologies continue to be built. YouTube, I think, is really a part of that. And then we're going to see, I think, a lot more litigation about fair use, because digital technologies are making new kinds of creativity possible and distributing it to the world. So you have the Google Print case, or I guess what's now called the Google Library Project, where Google is scanning books in order to make them searchable. That's a big fair use question. I think YouTube is going to throw off lots of fair use questions. People are making, I mean, the 2008 political campaign is going to be wall-to-wall video parodies, satires, and mashups. And there will be lawsuits as people try to censor and silence that new mode of political expression. And from my perspective, I am looking forward to those suits because for too long, fair use battles have just been about whether one big record company can use samples from another big record company. It's about time the debate come back to stuff that matters to the new citizen creators that populate places like YouTube.
For we mentioned the EFF site, but I guess last question, Fred. For those that want to learn more about these, about this area generally, aside from the website, which is an excellent resource, do you have any other suggestions for people?
Yeah, well, the great news is, of course, the blogosphere does a wonderful job here. I'll put in a plug for some of my favorites. There's a website called Freedom to Tinker that's run by Professor Ed Felton at Princeton. Very brilliant professor, brings the technology issues down to a layperson's level in a way that's great. Professor Eric Goldman at Santa Clara Law School has a marketing and technology blog that he covers the breaking legal issues there in a way that's fantastic. Public Knowledge in Washington, D.C., another public interest organization devoted to getting the balance right between IP and creativity and freedom. They have a great website as well. So the good news is there's no shortage. Of course, boingboing.net is a place where a lot of these issues get aired, thanks to our former EFF colleague, Cory Doctorow. So there's a lot of places to go. There's no shortage of coverage. You know, at the end of the day, follow, you know, if you're a fan, if you care about music, if you care about film, if you care about television, if you care about the kind of creativity you see on YouTube, you're going to be hearing about these issues because these issues are going to be top line for every media outlet that, that covers those issues.
Fred von Lohman from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I want to thank you for trekking down from San Francisco and being on, you have the honor of, being the guest on the last show for Hearsay Culture that I think I'll be recording at KZSU Studios for quite a while. So thank you for joining me today, for a fascinating discussion. And of course, it goes without saying, best of luck in EFF's efforts, which, you know, have my full, hearted support. And indeed, I've made some donations.
And we appreciate it, and thanks to everybody else out there who is a donor and a member. Thanks.
Thank you. I want to thank Fred von Lohman for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. As always, you can hear the show a number of ways. Hopefully you're listening on KZSU, but if you're not, you can also catch the show on hearsayculture.com by podcast or through the iTunes page at Center for Internet Society, through iTunes, or lastly through the CIS webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Also, Fred mentioned a number of links. You can find all of those links, in fact, on the blog roll that I have on the Hearsay Culture website. So I want to thank Fred von Lohman for being here today and for having a great discussion. Stay tuned to KZSU for its great programming, which continues, and I will talk to you again next week.